Hi, listeners. Join us on April 26th for Speech Therapy PD's Autism Conference, Embracing Joy Through Practical Intervention. Earn 0.6 ASHTA CEUs and engage in sessions grounded in neurodiversity-affirming, strength-based care. You'll gain a deeper understanding of how to support more meaningful and joyful participation for autistic children and adults. Register and learn more today at SpeechTherapyPD.com. You're listening to a Speech Therapy PD podcast. Earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode by completing the accompanying course online at SpeechTherapyPD.com.
Getting a child to say a good ER sound is one thing, but getting them to use it consistently is another. Now, you know the EZR program for getting the ER, but what about generalization? Well, what about the new R speech practice audios? Kids love to practice them, and you quickly access them via QR codes. Go to SpeechDynamics.com to take advantage of the 40% off sale price. Do it now. Welcome to the Speech Link. I'm your host, Shar Beauchart, and I invite you to listen and learn practical strategies from experienced experts to take your therapy to the next level. Personally, I can't remember what I did yesterday, much less 10 years ago. But fortunately for us, my guest does. She takes us through detailed experiences of working in a very special classroom with severely disordered teenaged young people. And I don't know how she did it, but as she shared, I felt like I was actually there in the room with the kids observing her therapy strategies. For example, she gives us a detailed account of how she expertly used role play videos in therapy that applied and transitioned into use in real situations. Get your listening ears on, along with paper and pencil. Here we go. Terry Farnham, MACCC, SLP, is a speech-language pathologist who has worked in a variety of settings for several decades, including 20 years in the schools as well as in clinics and hospitals. She is a therapist's therapist. Currently, she has her own private practice in Mount Vernon, Ohio, called Clarity for Communication. She is an informed and experienced specialist in pediatric speech, language, and assistive technology services. In fact, she was the 2018 recipient of the National Patricia Lindemood Clinical Leadership Award for her role in promoting evidence-based practice and phonology within the profession. Very cool. In addition, she shared her practical knowledge via seminars for many years, including the Bureau of Education and Research, and that's where we met. And she's a popular presenter for conferences and conventions. She presents on a variety of professional issues, including how and why to do language samples and analysis, which is our very practical topic for today. Welcome to the Speech Link, Terry.
It's great to be with you, Shar. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. Thanks for coming back. This is your second podcast.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I have heard you say that language sampling and analysis is not just for the communication sciences and disorders graduate assistant. So in your paradigm of knowledge, what's behind that statement?
I have supervised a lot of clinical fellows over the years, and every time language sampling comes up, you can see the deer in the headlights expression come over their faces because it's so much work. They think, because in graduate school, when you are supporting somebody's research, doing language sampling, you are doing phoneme by phoneme analysis, you're recording hours and hours and hours and transcribing hours and hours and hours of information to do comparisons and so forth. And the CFs tend to not view it as something that's practical to be done in real time in the field. My experience is that it's quite the opposite. It's my favorite kind of assessment to do because it gives me so much information about what kids know and how they use what they know about speech and language.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. And I would tend to agree with those clinical fellowship students because, yeah, it is time consuming. And, you know, a lot of the things that happen in the university, like sitting down for an hour and doing a case history, that doesn't happen.
Exactly.
And doing, you know, this heavy duty, long language analysis, that just doesn't happen. But Terry, you use it in your practice and you use it successfully. And it gives you information, and I'm sure that you get a baseline, and you probably don't do just one language sample with your kids. You probably do several, getting information about how they're improving and so on. But tell me, why do you do it? I mean, those, I'm just surmising, but why do you do a language sample and analysis?
Well, when I returned to public education as a practice site, I was working exclusively in preschool, and I had a lot of young children at age 3 coming over from early intervention and kids coming in from off the street, you know, to be evaluated and so forth. And children with very little language and very little ability to respond to standardized tests. And so I started doing language sampling to see what they knew, what their vocabulary was like in a play setting. How many words could I elicit in the half hour that we were allotted? How many things did they know? What other kinds of communication did they do? And so from that, I was able to at least establish a baseline that said, here's where we're starting. The standard score that said less than 65 was not helpful when they didn't respond to more than 2 items. That didn't give me much information. But a play-based language sample told me a lot about what they were able to do and what they knew about communication, what they knew about the give and take of communication, and what they didn't know. And at that age, there's a very simple measure of what they should be producing. At age 2, children should have an average of 2 words in an utterance. Mm-hmm. At age 3, it should be 3, and on up through age 5 or 6. So it became very easy to set goals for language development. And what I really like about it is that it allows me to look at lots of areas. If I have a child who comes in that's using one word phrases, maybe 2 occasionally, but the average is 1.2 or something that, say MLU. I can work on vocabulary. I can work on pragmatics. I can work on syntax. I can do all those things based on their MLU. So I don't have to write a specific goal about syntax,
right,
a specific goal about vocabulary, and then have to, you know, document that somehow. The paperwork can be overwhelming if you have the number of goals needed for a child who has very limited verbal output. You're going to spend most of your time writing progress reports because you've got all these goals. So, but if you write that they're going to participate in, you know, a play-based activity and have an MLU of 2.5, you've brought them from 1.2 to 2.5, hopefully, maybe even 3. 2 years of growth that is well documented as a solid measure of that kind of growth. And I can work on anything on any given day. I can, if I see that they don't have the words to talk in the social dramatic play area when the other kids are playing restaurant, I can sit in there and we can work on that. If we're working on making those sentences longer, maybe I'm going to pull them aside and we're going to work on that a little bit, but I can do all those things under the umbrella of increasing their MLU because all of those things feed MLU. It's a nice big measure.
Oh, ingenious. Good for you, because language is complex. There's so many components.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you can go crazy just trying to write it all down and, oh, hit all the marks. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you try to identify every little piece of syntax that they need to know, you're going to go crazy too. But if you're deleting copula and articles and infinitives and that sort of thing, that becomes a goal. But if you start putting them in it feeds your MLU as well. So yeah. All those things, it just worked beautifully at that age to measure what the global growth that I wanted to see in kids.
That is so smart, Terry. That is probably one of the smartest things I have ever heard. I am totally serious.
You're too kind. You're too kind.
Oh, no. It's something that all of us can do. And it's like this very, very broad goal. And then, of course, you have all these smaller benchmarks underneath there if you need to put a few of those down. That is so small. Okay, let's look at doing the initial language sample, the analysis. Do you record it? Do you sit and type it as you go? How do you do it? And does it differ between ages and levels of students?
Well, back in the day when I started doing this with preschoolers, I did not have a computer to use. That gives you any idea of how long ago that was. Mm-hmm. Early 90s.
Right.
And but I was dealing with children who had very limited verbal output. So I mostly hand wrote it. When I understood the words, I wrote them down. And if I didn't, I put a long line to show that there was a word there that I could count, even if I didn't understand what it was. I did audio recordings at that point, and then within about 95, we started getting some video equipment for our program, and I started using that, mm-hmm. and that was helpful, but it was very cumbersome. Today, it is so easy to record and get a good recording. You, of course, have to have parent permission to record, but beyond that, it's so simple because you can use your iPad or your phone. And you can literally scrub through frame by frame. When you miss something, you can go back and you watch the child's mouth slowly articulating what it was backwards till you get to the place where you know you were, and you move forward. None of that watching the counter on the cassette recorder thing anymore. It's so simple. And having the video also helps you know what the context was, especially if you're doing a play-based kind of assessment. Because you won't, if you just are recording, you may not know what the child is trying to do when you're trying to figure it out later. Modern recording has just made it easy.
Yes. Do you have any favorite apps that you like to use?
I just use the video camera on my phone or my iPad.
Okay.
And I don't do any editing because I want the whole thing. That's it. That's
right.
My corpus.
Right.
So I, right. You know, then I store it in a secure file or on a flash drive, you know, in the locked drawer and all that stuff. And that's it. You can export anything from your phone as a MP4. And so it can be viewed anywhere. I actually had, when I was getting ready for our conference where I was presenting on this, I had a child at the local parochial school who was just charming, utterly charming, and was a perfect example of the things that you can measure using mean length of utterance and just the whole language sample analysis. And when I asked her parents if it would be okay, her mother's response was, "Can we have the recording?" I was like, yes, of course you can. And she was utterly delightful. I'm sure it's going to be something they go back to, you know, when it's high school graduation time and they're going to play this and say, "Oh, look at how cute you were."
Yes.
She was utterly charming. But so I have often offered that as well, using video in other contexts too.
Yeah.
You give it to the parents so they know exactly what you've recorded and there's no mystery about it.
Yeah, there you go. Good idea. Well, I have a suggestion. I have used something on my phone called Quick Voice 2, like the number 2, text. Quick Voice to Text.
Ah.
Okay. And there's one that comes in that's blue, blue icon.
Okay.
But you want the one that's red. And I think it's like, I don't know, $2 or $3 or something. And it's not a big deal. But here's what you can do. Not only can you record their voice, okay, it's not visual, it's just audio recording, but you can then email it to yourself or to the teacher or to the parent, and it will transcribe it into text. Yes. It's the only thing that I know where you can end up with a recording and a transcribed text. because there's Dragon and, you know, a few others that, you know, you can just talk and then it'll just type it for you, but you don't end up with a recording.
Very nice. I will have to try that. I wonder what it does, do you know, with children with intelligibility issues?
I know exactly what it does. It doesn't transcribe a thing on that. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't say, oh yes, that was supposed to be an L. No, it ends up gobbledygook, but at least you have something there. And if you have the recording, you can go back and, you know, isolate what they did.
It takes another layer of objection away, because if you don't even have to transcribe it, you just have to go back and check at somebody else's transcription, then you're way ahead.
Yes.
I've kind of got a little system going where I record it, video record it, and then I type as I'm listening to the recording and scrubbing back through and all that sort of thing after the child is gone, and I'm generating the printed sample. And then I take the sample, and I thought, this is, you know, life has gotten so much easier. Even when technology fails, it's still better than the alternative. I copy, I will put it in, type it in a word processing document, hit enter, return at the end of every utterance. And then at the end of the day, well, at the end of the sample, I have a word count, because the word processor counts it, whether it's a real word or whether it's something the kid made up or whether I have put in phonetic fonts. If there's a space before and after it, it counts it as a word. Mm-hmm. Then all I have to do is select it all and use bullets and numbering, number it. I know how many utterances there were. And you've got the foundation for MLU for words right there.
Very cool. Wow.
And it's so simple. But now if somebody's going to transcribe it for me, that would be even better.
Yes.
So you just took another step away.
The
thing that I learned recently that has changed a little bit in the word processor that I use, I used to, as I mentioned, when I was hand transcribing on the fly while the kids were in the room with me, I would use a big underline to show that there was a word that was unintelligible. So I just have done that. When typing, I just, you know, put like a blank and go on to the next thing, space before and after. It used to count it as a word. Somewhere in the last 12 months, it stopped counting that as a word. So now I put XXXX with space before and after. So I know there was a word there that was unintelligible. It will count that as a word. Mm-hmm. So that's just a little tweak that has to be done to make it work better.
Yeah. Well, you know, in preparation for our time today, I did some research and I came up with a research article that was published in 2016. Mm-hmm. And the title is Use of Language Sample Analysis by School-Based SLPs, Results of a Nationwide Survey. Mm-hmm. And it's Pavelko, I think is the last name.
Yes.
And it looks like they sent out over 1,300 surveys. And, you know, they came up with lots of information and data and so on. But the bottom line is, and why I'm mentioning it, is that at that time, and the survey went out in 2012, 2013, mm-hmm. that very few people in the schools, few SLPs, were doing language samples and analysis. And their number one concern was that it was too time consuming. 78% of those that responded said it was too time consuming. And what you are telling me are some ways to cut that time consumption of, because you have to work with the child. I mean, that's not part of the time element, but it's that analysis of, mm-hmm. and you are giving some very creative, very foundational ways to save time. But how do you analyze the actual language piece?
Well, MLU, I've already mentioned, and that is, you know, that's the, kind of the gold standard till you get to a certain age, around, you know, 6 or 7, that nice straight line, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 words tends to taper off. So then it becomes a little more difficult. Where I go, for younger children, I'm going to do MLU for sure, and older kids as well, because lots of times they don't have good output, even if they are capable of it. Mm-hmm. Then I'm also going to look, there's MLU words. And I think this is another thing that is kind of that, I did this in grad school, I'm never doing it again, reaction, is that there are lots of ways of looking at MLU, or a couple of ways. And one is morphemes. And that really seems to escalate what you have to look at. I mean, you have to be much more fine-grained and careful about looking at each word and seeing what's there, et cetera, et cetera. So to count each one, but the reality is, according to research, that those two measures, MLU words or MLU morphemes, really aren't that much different. They don't, it doesn't distinguish between children who are using lots of words but not a lot of morphemes, or children who are using morphemes appropriately and using a lot of words. It doesn't seem to draw that line. It could give you some information for growth for a child who has no verb endings or plurals and that sort of thing, but it may not. You probably don't have to start there. You can just do MLU.
Right.
Another thing you mentioned we touched on articulation. One of the things I look at too is how many words were correct in the sample. Most of the research in phonology, articulation, speech intelligibility, their analysis is the number of phonemes correct, or the percent of phonemes correct. And I'm here to tell you, I don't have time to count phonemes.
No.
And when you've got a kid who's unintelligible, what phoneme are they saying? How many were there?
Yeah.
Who knows? So you can't do that. But I've always been looking for a measure of intelligibility. And what I finally came up with was to do the language sample. Mm-hmm. And then, backing up here a little bit, one of the issues with intelligibility is that we're speech-language pathologists. Third session, most of what the kid says is completely intelligible to me because I have figured out their system, even if they're highly unintelligible. Yeah. So my rating of intelligibility is highly suspect. But even though I can understand them, I still can recognize an error when I hear one.
Right.
So if I go back and do the language sample, I'm going to count how many words had no errors in them at all, no speech sound errors. And then I'm going to divide that by the total number of words spoken, which my word count gave me. So I do have to count words without errors. I have to highlight them or some, you know, give some indication that the which words were correct and which weren't. And I get a percent of words correct. For a child I'm working with right now, it was 24% of his words had no errors.
Okay.
So my goal then becomes that he's going to produce, In a language sample, 75% of the words are going to be spoken completely correctly. So if he makes an R error in the middle of the word, it's wrong. I'm not shooting for 100% for a four-year-old. I'm shooting for something that's going to be a whole lot better than what he's got at 24%. And, you know, we're going to get there. And it becomes a very easy way to measure progress. Because the first time I do a sample, my tendency is to type the words that were correct, just because it's easier than transcribing them phonetically. The words that were incorrect, I'm going to transcribe phonetically, and then I'm going to count up those things at the end and get the percent of words correct. The next time I do it, I understand the kid. I'm just going to type what I hear or let Quick Voice transcribe it. And then I'm going to underline the words that had errors in it. Mm-hmm. And then I just, much easier to count and a lot less transcription time. And what I'm going to see is that percent of words correct is going to rise over time. And what we're getting then is an indication of their overall intelligibility, their overall improvement, not strictly intelligibility, but speech sound production in a global way, just like MLU gives it for language for young children.
Yes. You know, I'm also wondering, does the activity have something to do with it and the manipulatives and the things that you're playing with and things that you're doing? Because, you know, if you're working with a ball 1 week, and then, you know, the next week you're, you know, blowing bubbles or something, you're going to be getting different words. Do you try to have some level of consistency so that you can get similar content of the words?
Well, yes and no. What I tell okay. you with very young children, I'm going to play with my barn and farm animals and that sort of thing, or the house, or something like that. So there are manipulatives. We've got a chance to have a nonverbal conversation as well as a verbal conversation. You know, mm-hmm. I can put things, have the people talk to each other and all that sort of thing. So that's what I'm going to do there. And that may continue, or they may get to a level that, you know, that really doesn't measure what they can do anymore. There's a fair amount of research out there that says that, you know, there's really two ways of sort of eliciting language. And one is a conversational sample and the other is a narrative sample, story retelling. Mm-hmm. And what they found is there's not, again, a significant difference between those two kinds of means of collecting a language sample for children up through about age 6 or 7. Uh-huh. Beyond that, then narrative becomes the way to measure those longer sentences that you want to hear, how many different kinds of complexity in their sentences they're using. That kind of thing emerges in narrative and isn't typically seen to a great enough degree to be measured in conversation.
Okay, that makes total sense. So do you ever use wordless books?
Yes, actually, that's usually my starting point. I got into wordless books after, you know, kind of trying to catch up on developments in narrative structures and that sort of thing. And what they use for all the research is, or much of it, is the Boy, Dog, and Frog series by Mercer Mayer.
Right.
And so I have several of those, and I'll give one of those one time, and I'll have them tell another story the next time, or maybe the same story again. Mm-hmm. And I found that from age 4 on, most children will simply tell me the story. I don't have to tell them the story and then ask them to retell it. And in fact, for a young child, that is somewhat intimidating, I think, because they feel like they have to tell it exactly the way you told it. And instead, we just do kind of a back and forth. We'll look at the page. You know, if he doesn't seem to be looking at the thing that is the main occurrence on that page, I'll go, oh my gosh, look what happened to the frog. Mm-hmm. And then wait for the child to respond. And so that's pretty much how I do it. And then for older children, the suggestion now, it's fun that we're doing this today. I got an email, I believe it was yesterday or the day before, from Plural Publishing that Marilyn Nippold has just published a book on language sampling. And she did a whole lot of research on how to elicit language samples that are meaningful for analysis, that is, from older children, including adolescents. Wow. And one of the things that she did was use fables. Read the fable together with pictures, cover up the text, and then have the child retell the fable. That's the first phase of the language sample. And then she has a series of 4 questions that she asks about the fable that give an idea of what the child's understanding of the fable is, and also can elicit those kind of complex sentences that we should be hearing. Here's her questions. Do you agree with the moral of this story? Mm-hmm. Why do you agree, or why do you disagree? Can you think of an example in real life where that moral would apply? Is there anything you would like to add about the moral of this story? So you've got them thinking at a much more abstract level than just retelling a story, and then having to share their reasoning verbally, which is going to draw out a lot more complex sentences. And in fact, I'm just looking at total communication units for one of those fables was... Oh, that's total number of sentences. I'm sorry. Between 18 and 20. And then the mean for the MLCU, she calls it mean length of communication unit, mm-hmm. 11 to 12 words. So that's a significant rise over what we expect to see if a child's just having a chat.
Yes.
So it's a very interesting strategy. I'm anxious to see how she fleshes that out in the book.
You know, I saw that book too. We must have got the same email. Yeah. And I'm thinking about getting it. But I have a resource that I'd like to throw out. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite authors is Marianne Hoberman.
Oh, yes.
So you know her too, H-O-B-E-R-M-A-N. She has a book on fables. And, you know, she has a series, I'll Read to You, You Read to Me. Uh-huh. And there's many books, and I probably have most of them. There's even a really cute one on Halloween stories. But the one on fables is more advanced language-wise, as far as the total words and the number of words in the sentences and the complexity of the information is much more advanced. Mm-hmm. And I would highly recommend that book. And the fables are really good. Mm-hmm. And she has other books that have much easier reading, lower level of reading, but they're usually very fun, very well written, very interesting.
Excellent. Excellent. You know, the other thing, as I thought about the whole fable thing, was that one of the things I like about doing language sample analysis is that it gives me that broad picture, but I can also look within that broad picture at the big areas within language and think of the pragmatic information you would get from having a child retell a fable and then explain why or why not, why it was true or why it wasn't true, the moral,
yes,
why that made sense, and relating an incident where they had seen it happen or not happen. I think you would get a tremendous amount of pragmatic information. You know, we have checklists for pragmatics, and there are some really good tools out there where children are looking at pictures and, you know, they have chaotic scenes and tell me what's wrong. What, tell me about the girl at the desk who's, and they, what should she say? Yeah, that's it. But it's still contrived. In this kind of situation, it's not contrived. It's real. It's real language. It's coming out of my head, and I am trying to explain to you why this is the case.
Yes.
And if I can't do that, then I've got some pragmatic language deficit.
That makes total sense. We hopscotched from 2 and 3 year olds up to maybe to adolescence, and we kind of left out some of those, the middle ground. And the middle ground is usually where most of us think of doing a language sample. And that is, it is much more complex and just it takes a little more work. So fill us in on maybe what you use, how you analyze, and you've talked about some of the things that you look at, but maybe you could get a little bit more detailed. Let's say I'm working with, you know, a first grader or a second grader, you know, of fairly average intelligence and, you know, good cognitive skills. But how do we approach those levels of kids and their language?
I am inclined to use the story retell for those kids because it does elicit more complex language, less cocktail speech, so to speak. I mean, if we're just having a chat, a kid can come across really well. Mm-hmm. And still have some gaping holes in their language ability. Where if they're having to retell a story, they're having to call up relevant vocabulary. They're having to give me the sequence of events. They're having to explain cause and effect. There's a lot of things happening in a story retell that don't happen in just conversational give and take. Especially with the give and take piece, when we're having a conversation, we don't tend to speak in big, long sentences. I tell you something and you go, that happened to me last week. And you tell me something, but we're not speaking at erudite academic kinds of levels where telling a story requires some of that. So one of the things to look at when they are retelling a story is the number of different words they use. And there's actually some guidance from the literature. I have a handout that's at my Teachers Pay Teacher site that has a summary of a bunch of the articles about children up to about age 8, I think it is. So I count total number of different words. What difference does that make? Well, there are articles that say at age 6, it looks like this. At age 8, it looks like this. So you can ballpark. It's not standardized assessment, but you can say, wow, he only used 75 different words in 10 minutes. And this says he should be using, you know, 200 different words in, mm-hmm. in a 50 utterance sample. That's probably extreme, but it's easy to measure. believe it or not, because you can use a spreadsheet to do it. You type in the first word that you hear, go to the next line, type in the next one, type in the next one, type in the next one. Oh, wait, it pops up with a list of words because you've already used those first two letters once. You look and see if the word you're about to type is there. If it is on that list, that means it's already been counted. You don't type it. You type the next one.
Ah.
And then you, when your spreadsheet's done, you go down to the bottom and you say, oh, 175 lines. He used 175 different words.
Interesting. Now, are you in Excel, that kind of thing?
Actually, I'm a Mac user, so I'm using numbers. But yeah, Excel would do the same thing for you.
Numbers. Okay. But they're probably comparable.
Yeah. You know, if you're a real spreadsheet person, Excel's better. but I'm not. Numbers works for me for what I need it for.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds very helpful. So you're taking, what, maybe a half hour to do this tally? Something like that?
Oh, yeah. Not even.
Not even. Okay. And then what else do you do? Are you looking at the, you know, are they nouns? Are they verbs? Did they throw any adjectives in there?
Yes. Then I'm going to look more closely at that kind of thing to see what my starting point is. But I may or may not summarize that in the report. That's more for my informing my first session with the child. He used lots of nouns and not a lot of adjectives at all. Well, let's start with adjectives. If we're going to expand the length of their sentences, that's where we're going to go first.
Okay.
The other thing that I find very interesting to look at, that when I first read about it, I thought, oh, that is what kids do. And it's amazing. Which is the false starts, repetitions, corrections, going back and starting over, making revisions in their spontaneous language. Kids who have language disabilities do that a whole lot more than other kids. We all do it. I'm notorious. But these kids actually do it more. And they're, Ledholm, McLaughlin, Newman, Scott and Windsor, a whole bunch of studies beginning in the late 80s calculated frequency of mazing in typical language development. So you can use those numbers and say, wow, look, Jeffrey is just, look how many times he stopped and started, how many times he said how many words he didn't actually finish, put in the last word in the sentence. He couldn't complete the sentence because he wasn't sure what should go there. Gives you lots of information. And again, that's a measure you can use to measure progress. Is he doing less of that on a specific topic? Maybe he's fine in conversation. He probably is. Got good cocktail speech. But when it comes to retelling a story from language arts, he can't remember what those stronger verbs were. He doesn't have those at his immediate disposal. So we can work on those kinds of things and build that level of understanding that will reduce, in consequence, the number of amazing events in the sample. And, you know, it's interesting to me that everybody does it, children and adults. This little girl I mentioned whose parents wanted the video of her giving her language sample, she had a number of amazing events in a 50 utterance sample. I think she had 11. Well, it was more than 50. It was 94 total, I think. Anyway, but 11 amazing events and of significance. But for her age, that was below the mean for her age.
Oh.
So that word retrieval, not an issue for her.
Okay. All right. So where do I get that kind of really specific information?
I summarized it all in a table with ages and studies and the different measures of so that I could refer to it. And so now I'm sharing it with the world at Teachers Pay Teachers.
Love it. Okay. So what is your store at Teachers Pay Teachers?
It's called Clarity SLP.
Clarity SLP. Wow. I'm going to go there and get that. That is amazing. So you looked at all of the research studies or somebody has written about it. Honestly, I mean, that makes so much sense to me. I do not remember that word amazing. Is it M-A-Z-I-N-G or is it more complex than that?
M-A-Z-I-N-G.
Okay.
And what it is just like you're in a maze and you go this way and you hit a wall and you come back and you go that way and you hit a wall and you come back and you gradually get to where you need to be. And I thought, this is fantastic.
Yes.
This is exactly And if you think about those upper elementary kids with weak language, that is how they talk. That is their classroom performance.
Wow, what a gem. Oh my gosh, you are amazing. Wow, I'm learning so much. This is great, great. Okay, keep going. So what else do we need to know?
Some researchers talk about talkativeness, and that's kind of summarized in total number of utterances. I mean, some kids are taciturn. They don't respond well, but generally when they know you, they will chat with you and so forth. So the sheer number of things, of utterances that they produce, actually becomes a measure of their confidence as much as anything, I think, with language. Mm-hmm. Are they willing to express themselves, or are they going to do nonverbal stuff? Because it's very meaningful for young children, but also for older kids. They're going to back off when the subject becomes unfamiliar, or when they feel like they're not able to express what they want to express. So the total number of utterances is actually a measure as well. And that's more of a time-based measure than based on a 50 utterance sample, because you know what the total number is for a 50 utterance sample, it's 50. So you're going to give them some time, say 10 minutes, and you're going to count the number of utterances in 10 minutes, and then hope to make that change as they learn for pragmatics, for example, strategies for introducing a new topic of conversation, or shifting the focus of the conversation to something related to what you're talking about. Those kinds of strategies could be measured with the total number of utterances, possibly. A number of different words we've talked about. And that's, you know, to me, that's a really great vocabulary measure. Uh-huh. I love Judy Montgomery's vocabulary test, the MAVA, but she has a select group. I mean, we're only testing a few hundred words in both forms. That really doesn't give us a picture. And, you know, when children get to the two-word utterance phase, unless you're working as a graduate assistant, counting the total number of words a child has in their vocabulary is beyond the reach of any speech pathologist. And you know, it's in the thousands. And so, and when they're in elementary school, it's in the tens of thousands. We can't go there physically, mentally, we can't go there. But the total number of words they use in a given context is kind of a like taking your temperature for that. If you've got enough words to talk about this topic, you're going to use the average number of words. If you don't have enough words, or if the words are there and you can't retrieve them, you're going to get a lower total number of words. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a health indicator of the strength of the child's vocabulary. Just like if you take your temperature, right now, you know, if it's up, you're going to go, oh, do I have COVID? But it doesn't mean you have COVID. You could have some other kind of infection. And that's what a lot of these measures do. I mean, they're sort of global measures, but they're real. They're from the child's actual speech. And you can redo them again and again and again, because it's also not something that you're going to breach the standardization of. If you could take a language sample every day if you wanted to, because kids are talking every day.
You know, this is probably the quintessential way to keep data.
Yes.
Yeah. And not only is it documentation for what the child is doing, but it gives you information as to what to do.
Yes. Yes. That's why I value it, because it gives me valid information about what to do. I can give the self. I like the self. I like Wayne Secord.
Sure. Who doesn't?
He's so fun.
He is. He's a funny guy.
But it's taking narrow slices. I can get really good syntax information from some of the self tasks, but measuring whether the child is using it in conversation or not, it's a little dicey if I'm going to get that from the self.
No, you're not.
Right.
That's because you're not.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But with a language sample, you can.
Yeah.
I want to be sure and mention there's a couple of things commercially available that will do language sample analysis kind of for you. There's a thing called SUGAR that stands for Sampling Utterances and Grammatical Analysis Revised. SugarLanguage.org. It's free. you have to do your own transcription and all that sort of thing, but it does some of these measures for you if you enter it at the website. The other one is salt. Isn't that cool? Sugar and salt. And that is the systematic analysis of language transcripts. Salt is a subscription service. I'm not sure what it costs these days. It's pricey. But if you're doing a lot, it's really designed for graduate programs who are doing majors, have lots of language samples to gather and so forth. But if, you're really busy, this could be a solution. And they also offer a transcription service.
Okay.
So you can record the sample and send it to them. So that's a possibility as well. And that is saltsoftware.com.
Okay. What else do you have on your site regarding language sampling? At Teachers Pay Teachers? Because I mean, what you are saying and how you have described what you do makes perfect sense to me as far as the amount of time that you have to put in and also the results of what you get out of it. It makes so much sense to do this. But if I were to sit down with a child, I could probably generate the recording and so on, but what do I do after that? Okay. Do you have instructions have you written any of this down?
I don't, but I could do that. I don't have that there now. Sometimes, how it is, things just seem so obvious.
Yeah. Well,
that why would I tell somebody how to do this? Because it seemed obvious to me. But
right.
What's obvious to me is not obvious to others, and what's obvious to others is not necessarily plain to me. So I will think about doing this.
Yes, please do that.
I've got several pieces I could put together to put in to give some specific instruction.
And I don't know, we could call it what, pepper?
Yeah. Okay. Or cinnamon.
Cinnamon. Yes, there you go. We need to stay within the condiments. Okay. Wow. Is there anything we have missed that you would like to interject here?
Well, I usually start, and I kind of just breezed on past it, with Laura Justice and Aaron Riedel in their introductory text for our profession talk about the purposes of communication. Mm-hmm. And I have returned to those multiple times and now in multiple contexts. I mean, it's kind of the framework I use for AAC as well as lots of other things and language sampling. The purposes are instrumental. That is getting things done. I need this. Can I have that? Regulatory. You go get it for me. Interactional. We know what that means. And that is a very powerful kind of important sort of purpose of communication. Personal, I feel sick today, my heart is heavy, isn't this delightful? Those are personal communications. Heuristic, asking questions. Imaginative, I love this because preschool was absolutely my favorite age to work with. And that's their whole life. But they're using imagination to build their language and to have interpersonal communication and interactional things going on. And then informative. And that tends to be what we think of. I can tell you, what state I live in and how many acres we sit on and all that kind of stuff. That would be informational, but that's really often not all that important to kids. But none of those things is measured on a standardized test.
Mm-hmm.
If you use a language sample, you will get information about each one of those purposes.
Very good. Very, very good. I feel another podcast coming on with you because, you were talking about all the different styles of communication and so on. And much of that is dependent on who you're talking with. And if you have a parent that is saying something more than giving commands. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And I'm thinking that I probably need to talk with you about talking with parents and how they shape their language to ensure that they get that variety of words and utterances and so on.
And purpose.
Is that something that you focus on?
Yes, I would love to do that.
Okay. See, that makes sense to me too. Because, and I remember reading Hardin Risley, Risley's book.
Yes.
And, you know, about their, you know, research that they did, they went out and they recorded interactions in the home and so on. And many of the utterances that parents were saying was basically, do this, don't do that, bring that here. But, you know, they were commands and directives, and that was, you know, that was kind of it. And that so much of a child's vocabulary development is dependent upon those early, early years. And I would think that a language sample would point out some of those types of things that kids are saying and not saying, and that it would be beneficial to talk with the parents and disclose some of that information.
Yes. Yes.
Is that something that you would be willing to talk about at some point?
Yes. Yeah. I'd love to talk with you about Hardin Risley for an hour.
Okay.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Yes. Such a powerful, enormous body of information.
Yeah, I know. Yes. Huge. Just huge. And it's, and you know what, when I go out and do seminars and I bring that up, I'm going to say 98% of the people in the audience had never heard of that study.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. It's appalling.
It is, because it's super, super critical. I mean, it's huge. It's just very, very important. So just know I'm going to give you heads up on that, because this is a super important topic. But, you know, we need to close out here, but I can only say thank you so much for your insight, your valuable information that you shared with us regarding language sampling. It just makes me want to go grab a child and record them.
I think it's getting over that initial hurdle that you can do this and it doesn't have to take the rest of your life to do the analysis. I, you know, it doesn't take that long to collect 50 utterances, which is the pretty much what you need.
Okay.
Studies looked at 100 and 300, and you know what? They're about the same as 50.
Ah.
So you don't, it doesn't have to take a lot of time to collect it. Analysis does take more time, but once you've done it a couple of times, it doesn't take that long either, especially when you know what specific targets you're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Very good. You know, I bet there are people listening that would love to contact you.
Sure.
Would you be willing to share your information, your email?
Sure. My private practice is called Clarity for Communication, no S on communication. And that's my email, clarityforcommunication@gmail.com.
Perfect. Thank you, Terry.
Well, thanks for having me, Shar. It's great to talk with you.
Yes. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello. Welcome, everybody. We are live now. I'm Shar Beauchart. And Terry, are you with us?
I am here.
Oh, good. Great. I'm so glad when this stuff works. Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing all of your great informative language sample suggestions. I love it. Very, very, very helpful. Very practical. And to those of you who are listening, if you have a question for Terry, please feel free to type it in and I'll read it and Terry will respond. Okay. So, but in the meantime, I do want to thank you all for being here and for continuing to get the word out about the SpeechLink podcast, where you earn CEUs, as you know. We greatly appreciate your reviews and all of your support. So I'm looking here. You know what? Just to get things going here, Terry, I'm going to ask you a question that I kind of wondered about after we ended our recording session. You explained such information that was just wonderfully unique and very direct and easy to do as far as generating a language sample. And, you know, it seems like it would be a really good policy to just add it to our customary diagnostic protocol, I would think. But I'm wondering, have you ever had an experience where you used, you know, the regular speech and language diagnostic tools and you also did your language sample and came up with significantly differing scores and indicators? Has that ever happened to you?
Actually, it has. In fact, it happened just recently again. I had a child of almost four whose mother was concerned about her speech sounds. She has an older brother who has significant speech sound issues, who's in therapy, and she wanted to be sure that she was on top of everything. She wanted to be sure that she got it, but she had been told that when she did her screening to go to preschool, maybe it was, that she was okay. She was going to be fine. And of course, we've all heard that before.
Right.
So she just wanted, she said, if you would just test her and see what you think. Well, the fact is, because she was not yet four and still isn't, the standardization, of course, is slightly different. Mm-hmm. When you hit age four, the expectation is for speech that you're going to be able to be understood by strangers for most of the time in unfamiliar contexts. Mm-hmm. And that was not true for this child. Now, she was just short of four, but the possibility of her shifting from probably about half intelligibility for me, just as an estimate, to 100% intelligibility in about 6 weeks' time is pretty small. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was one factor. The other thing was, though, that lots of times kids with phonologic errors also have many language errors as well. Mm-hmm. Lots of syntax and morphology and that sort of thing. So I always give them a language test to see what I can find out. So I gave her the Self Preschool, and on that she scored on every measure given. I didn't give her the whole test, within the average range. Mm-hmm. Her lowest score was on recalling sentences because she deleted some words, but that was a 7, which is still, you know, in the low average, but average range. And she had one score, a comprehension score, that was a 11, I think. So, you know, she would not qualify under Ohio's rules for special education, for special services, by any stretch. Her standard score on the Goldman Fristo was 79, which puts her outside of the average range, but not low enough to qualify. It has to be a 70. So, so I gave her, I took a language sample, as I always do, and in analyzing it, I discovered that most of her intelligibility issues are in connected speech, no surprise there, but they are related to syntax as much as they are to speech sounds. She did a lot more deleting of medial and final consonants in conversational speech, which I picked up on, things that she did not do in single word assessment. And then, but she also was deleting. She never used is. Hmm. She never used to. She never used any form of is. Her pronouns were off. She deleted lots of prepositions and that sort of thing. She had lots of ideas to express, but she expressed them extremely incompletely. And that did not show up. Of course, we're calling sentences. It did show up there, but it was still within the acceptable range because it was a repetition task, not a spontaneous generation task. And so in looking things over, I mean, she was stimulable for every sound. She was, there were none, I mean, I think TH was the only sound that she did not ever produce correctly on the test, but the picture was very different when you looked at her connected speech. Transcribing her sample turned out to be a pretty substantial challenge because of the interaction of morphologic and syntactic errors with speech sounds. Was she marking the past tense? You know, how did I tell? All that sort of thing. It all sort of gelled when I looked at the language sample, as opposed to if I had just looked at scores, I would have said, oh, just go on. You know, she'll be fine. Give her a little more time. Is that possible? Yes. Is it likely in my experience? No. Because, as I said, she's almost four. At four, she should be able to be understood. And she should not have all these syntax errors. And in fact, when I looked at total number of words used, her total number of words was low. So that tells me there might be some vocabulary issues, or that her difficulty constructing a sentence that makes sense limits her ability to retrieve and use the vocabulary that she has. Her comprehension was great, but she could not, she didn't manifest it in her expressive language. So, you know, in talking with her mom, our focus is going to be on some speech sounds, yes, but it's going to be more on syntax so that we can use those speech sounds in the context in which they need to be used. I really feel pretty strongly that in her case, certainly, but in many cases, those syntax issues are huge contributing factors to intelligibility because our English speaking ears are waiting for those little words, the, to, an, is, be, to smooth out the sentence so that we know what's coming next. When they're missing, we don't know. And we aren't able to shift and forget all that syntax knowledge that we have as native English speakers to accommodate what this child is doing in terms of deleting and omitting whole words from sentences as well as some sounds. Mm-hmm. In the previous podcast we did together, we were talking about children with significant disabilities, and I found the same to be true for them, that if we can clean up their sentence structure, actually that their intelligibility declines as their sentence structure improves, because the more words they put in, the less opportunity we have to understand. But when we can undergird that with correct use of all those little function words, then things get smoothed out again. But when they have a language surge, sometimes their parents think they're getting worse.
Wow. Very interesting. Very interesting. Now, you are in private practice, correct?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So if you were in the schools, the child would not have...
Not qualified.
Not qualified.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's a real answer to this. And I know that our time is getting close here, but do you know of any other way to discern what you found out? Is there another diagnostic tool that we could or should be using?
I think that there are some other language tools that might have revealed this. Things with sentence repetition tasks, I think about. I'm trying to think what's standardized on this age anymore.
Right, right. That is hard.
That's the other issue. And to be honest, the thing that I used to do when I was working exclusively in preschool, and I would have kids who didn't qualify, who I knew should, mm-hmm. who were near their birthday, my recommendation was that we test them after their birthday.
Yeah, yeah. They're going to be at the low end.
Or when the next cut point was on the standardization, and 9 times out of 10 they did qualify.
I'm with you. I've done that.
Right. And the other thing I did not do, the other thing I did not do for her was the sentence portion of the Golden Fristo, which might have
maybe
shown some of the she would have had more phonologic errors for sure, but I doubt if it would have dragged her down to 70 as a score.
Yeah, I doubt it. Thank you, Terry. Very interesting information. And I wish for everyone listening to stay safe and stay healthy. Hang in there. And thank you for all you do for your therapy kids. See you next time. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to The Speech Link. Please check out my other offerings at my website, charvauchart.com, and also speechtherapypd.com. See you next time for more interviews, information, and insights. Until then, thank you so much for all that you do with your speech kids. Be well, and God bless.
Remember to visit speechtherapypd.com to earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode and to see our library of over 1,400 courses for all things SLP.